Welcome to Developing the Trust, the podcast hosted by Tim Warnford, on which we talk all things schools and academisation. This week, Tim travels to Woodford to the offices of Chris James, a senior accountant at Allen Patient & Co., a London firm providing accountancy services to schools across the UK.
So one of the things I'd like to ask you, perhaps begin at the beginning, the services that you provide to academy schools today, did you come with those schools when they converted, or have you tended to pick them up once they have converted?
Yeah, so it's a real bag, really. So the first academy that we actually ended up working with, they converted back in 2011, and we started working with them about 3 years ago now. So they've gone through the whole conversion process. They've gone through all of the heartache and the pain already, but they were in a kind of a turning point, really. They just had some serious work done, sponsored by the EFA, and they had kind of got through that and had decided, right, okay, now what is it that we need to be doing to really help kind of our finances, manage those finances as well as we can, really just kind of, you know, make sure that when the auditors send their management report in, that those things are being dealt with, but also before they even get to that point, that the severity of those management points that they're picking up on are actually far reduced from what they've had in previous years.
So thinking about the experience that schools would have had prior to academising, there would very often be a, what we might humbly call a housekeeper, good housekeeping.
Yeah,
a bookkeeper
yeah.
would be sitting in the corner beavering away.
Yes, absolutely.
Obviously, one of the stipulations of becoming an academy is there's a much higher level of scrutiny and required from external auditors.
Yeah.
I suppose my question to you is, what do you see as the benefits of adopting a SIMS or a much higher graded accountancy system once you're an academy as part of the requirements for going across?
Yeah.
Where do you see the, because obviously there's a cost involvement for the school to invest in that. Where do you see the advantages and the benefits from that?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, there is far increased level of scrutiny on the schools. And so that goes through, you know, all the way from the school leaders to the trustees. So, you know, they're the ones that are ultimately responsible for it at the end of the day. So they need to have confidence in the systems that they have in place are actually making sure that they not just safeguard the money, but also that they're spending it in the right place. And like you say, it is an investment to make sure that happens and invest in those systems that will give you that. And so, yeah, I think, you know, the real benefit there is knowing actually if you spend the money on these systems that you are going to get better, what I would call financial clarity, so that, you know, at the end of the day, you can make the decisions which you need to make as an academy in a business market to, you know, make sure that you're giving the children of the school the best education that they can possibly have.
I mean, I totally agree with you insofar as it is an investment. There's not much of a choice insofar as that investment, because unfortunately they have to have that as you know, EFA rules. I suppose my question is, very often, so from a surveying point of view, for example, there may be times when a school to attract money will perhaps go for something like a biomass boiler.
Yeah.
And whilst it does all wonderful things, the actual skill level of the site manager to operate that unfortunately means that those advantages and benefits are never really properly derived.
Yeah.
With regards to their needing to take on this additional level of accountancy skills, is there not a strong case for you guys to be involved much earlier in the process so that they can understand better how they need to A, operate the system, and B, be able to extract that value?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I think that's a really good example that you used then, you know, not knowing much about facilities myself. Yeah, I can definitely see the comparison. And like you say, you know, you spend this money on getting this, you know, far better system that would be able to give you that clarity, would be able to give you that information that you need to run the trust more effectively. But like you say, unless you've got the person with the skills at the helm, then it is very difficult to get out of the system what it is that you're actually paying for. And yeah, I totally agree, you know, getting somebody like us in at an earlier stage, even at the stage where they're actually deciding on what system it is that they should be using going forward, is definitely advantageous. You know, you at the end of the day, it's all an investment, and you're only going to get that investment to pay dividends if you put that money in up front and if you put that time and effort in up front.
Absolutely. And using your chartered accountancy background and chartered surveyors background, for me, the key time to better prepare schools for the conversion process has to be at the due diligence stage.
Mm.
And as we know, more likely that the school will instruct a solicitor to assist with that due diligence. And sometimes I wonder whether our involvement at that early stage to better prepare the school as to their liabilities and to advise of their assets and to look at ways in which we can best work together to offset those identified liabilities at as early a stage as possible would put them in a stronger position for once they enter into that market arena.
Yeah.
And in many respects, this is kind of the whole raison d'etre for this whole podcast, is to find people like yourself providing those professional services, finding ways in which we can work more collaboratively to ensure that the schools have a better service at the front end so that they are better equipped. And that's the sort of thing I wanted to kind of to explore with you today. So insofar as successes, what have you noted insofar as where you have been able to have that impact at an earlier stage and be able to guide the school through the choppy waters of the market? What have you noted that, because basically I've effectively gone from public sector into the private. What experience can you share with me insofar as where you have been able to have a really big impact and assist them?
I think the successes we've had are when schools do come to us at an earlier stage, they're looking at the systems and they're going, right, okay, what is it that we need to do in order to make sure that we actually are a unit kind of financially, we are kind of all working together, we're making sure that the things that need to get done are getting done, but also as well that we are having that information available to us. And I think probably the biggest thing that's come out of those successes is that, for example, their first audit, they have no idea what's going to happen. I've had head teachers, chief financial officers, all kind of sitting there biting their nails, so tense that they don't know what the auditors are going to say. But for those schools, for those trusts that have actually taken the time and invested in decent systems and taken on the skills, the expertise that they need early on in the process, they've actually had some of the best audit outcomes that I've come across ever in schools. And that's really nice to see, because actually they're going, right, okay, have we made the right decision in doing all of this? And actually when the auditors show up and have actually had it say to the Board of Trustees, yes, this is one of the easiest audits that we've had for a first year ever, then you think, oh my God, it's such a relief. It really is. For those school leaders, for those trustees to kind of hear that, and they really grow in confidence then, and they think, right, okay, what's the next challenge? We've got past that particular hurdle. We've, survived our first period as a trust. Now, where can we go? What can we do to improve ourselves even more? Whereas when they haven't had that, it's a little more difficult, and they are always, I think you've said this already, they're always kind of trying to play catch up a little bit.
Absolutely. Do you note, with a secondary school and with perhaps a larger mat, you will potentially have a director of finance where perhaps the level of sophistication about being able to understand the value of your service, when you compare that with perhaps a single standalone primary school, is there a difference insofar as the sophistication of understanding of the value and the benefits that you can bring? Do they understand that after the first audit, or is it as light dawns gradually? Do they slowly understand it? Whereas I imagine with a finance director, he'd be only too delighted to work with you.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, funnily enough, actually, I think we do talk to finance directors quite often in secondary mats, where it's a case of they talk to us sometimes as kind of equals. It's a case of that they themselves may be qualified accountants, which it's always good to see that schools have got those skills and expertise in their trusts. And other times they see us as competition, that you want to take our job. But actually, I think we tend to find that the level of conversation that we can have with those finance directors is, like you say, a kind of a higher level, which is fantastic. But actually, we tend to talk to a lot of people who aren't on that level. Either they're in small primary mats or standalone secondaries, where actually they don't necessarily have the resources to actually source somebody who is a full-time finance director, but they still want to have those skills and they still want to have that expertise on their side. So it's a case of what they tend to do is look at us as a suitable alternative to engaging somebody, fortunately, who comes with the salary and things like that, to actually engage us and to have those skills and that knowledge on their side, while also managing a much smaller budget and making sure that they're not actually overspending on the person who's financially in control of the trust, but also sure they've got those skills, that knowledge.
With regards to frustrations, so I always use Lloyds Bank, who you probably know completely dominate this sector.
Yeah.
It's like between 85 and 90% of academies bank with Lloyds.
It's crazy.
And the reason why is because Lloyds invests so much time in providing very bespoke single point of contact resources for those schools. And the reason I say, insofar as frustrations, is that it's an emerging sector and they are a very needy sector from all of our perspectives because they grew up as teachers, not as asset managers or accountants, etc. Do you find a disproportionate amount of time that you need to invest back into that particular client? And if so, is there anything again that you think that having had that experience where you can maybe look at ways in which you could iron out those frustrations? What advice or what have you learned that you think, you know what, having been through this, we might make this leaner or smoother?
For us as a firm, we started off in the commercial sector. We have private clients who run their own businesses, their own companies. And I think, you know, the whole sector of accounting and finance has kind of grown up around that. Whereas for schools, for academies, this is brand new for them. They've never had to deal with this kind of level of compliance. They've never had to deal with this level of reporting before. And so it's a case of it is brand new to them, and it's scary. And for a lot of trusts that, like you said, they've got those skills, they've grown up as teachers and that's their career, they're now being asked to be accounting officers or chief financial officers, and it is completely brand new to them. And I think what's really important is to just to kind of be on their level, really, is to show that you do understand that what they're going through. And the best way to do that is to show that you've done it all before. And for them, it is the first time they're doing it. But actually, you've been through that process tens, dozens of times. And it's a case of you can actually say, look, this is going to work. It's going to be okay. And to really reassure them that they aren't necessarily alone in this. But I can definitely see from their point of view, from a trust, they're going, well, it's all on us now. Whereas before, they had the support of the local authority, for example, and was running along nicely. And they've really kind of come out and had to really strike out on their own. But there is support there. There are people there. There are firms there that can really help them out on these things by offering their time. And sometimes it is just a case of being a bit of a sympathetic ear. Obviously, you remain professional and you remain, you know, the kind of the go-to expert in that area. But at the same time, you are dealing with people who are being asked to do completely brand new and strange things, for them at least.
No, indeed. I mean, most of us operate in a world of risk and reward and the ratio between them. Many schools have converted at risk, were not necessarily aware of their liabilities, and I feel that their hands are somewhat tied with regards to what freedoms they're entitled to pursue with regards to perhaps raising their own finances.
Yeah.
We think of the restrictions on operating leases. Certainly an issue blessed with a freehold, then there's more difficulty with regards to the disposal of land, etc.
Yes.
Given the huge number of cuts, given the funding streams that are available and the number of people that are pursuing those, the pressure on those, I think that they need to clearly save every penny, maximise their existing resources and access all available funding streams.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, is that something that they call upon you to assist with?
Yeah, very often, It's a case of that they will be, you know, if they're not looking to cut costs to make their budget go further, they are looking for new revenue streams. And it's really hard sometimes to get that across to school trustees, to get that across to CFOs and accounting officers who haven't had to do that kind of thing before and really try to hammer it home that they are a business now. And while it's a case of they're not dealing with profits and shareholders, the money that they're raising, the income that they're trying to maximise is going back into providing the education for the children at their schools. And I think making that connection for them is sometimes where we come in. They're not necessarily asking us to maximise their income for them, but they're just kind of going, well, I don't know what to do. And it's a case of, well, actually telling them that cold hard fact that you do need to try and maximise your income. And sometimes that's something they don't want to hear because it is a completely new skill set for them.
Are you finding a rise in their seeking advice from you? I think of something like an operating lease where effectively there's an investment at the front end and there's maybe an 8-year payback period, etc. Are you finding yourselves more and more advising on those sorts of options?
Absolutely, yeah. Because these are big financial commitments for them and they want to make sure that before they do enter into an operating lease or something like that, that they're actually getting value for money from that. And that's the utmost importance for all academies, all school trusts, leaders and the trustees, is that they are obtaining value for money. And sometimes it's hard to see that without actually getting kind of somebody's expert eye on that to show them, yes, you are, or actually you might want to look at alternatives.
Just a couple of final questions.
Sure.
Obviously, this last couple of weeks, we've had the results from the Condition Improvement Fund back. And when the ESFA raised the value for money weighting from 15 to 25%, we were more than a little cautious as to what impact that may have on schools who do not have budgets from which to contribute. And bearing in mind that circa 50% of schools are now in year deficit, and that's just in the academy sector, let alone local authority, how are the 50% or more of our academy schools in year deficit who are unable to contribute, to make a contribution towards the SIF application or be able to access a SIF loan? Where do you see the future for those schools who are not able to financially support themselves?
It's rather bleak, unfortunately, and I think the ESFA are really tightening the screws on a lot of trusts, especially small trusts as well. I don't know if they've communicated it directly or not, but they've really said that it's a case of if you are a small trust or a standalone school, then really you should be joining a bigger trust. For a lot of schools, for a lot of small trusts, they want to operate independently because otherwise, they're kind of going back into the system where they were owned and run by the local authority. So it's really tough for them to kind of not get those SIF grants that they desperately need. Like you say, if they haven't got the money up front to do it. And yeah, I really do see, unfortunately, the only way that that's going to go is by those schools being absorbed by larger mats.
And as we know, it's never been a particularly attractive option for primary schools, which is why there's such a small percentage compared to secondaries that have gone.
Yeah.
And again, depending on the pyramidic arrangement, I suppose you could say that primary schools are in a bit of a Hobson's choice, really, because if they go into a pyramid, they're likely to be subservient to the secondary. However, by lining up with equivalent primaries, where you could argue that they're on a level playing field, they are actually in direct competition with those.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So there's not really an easy choice there, which is why I guess we can understand why so few are willing to go.
Yeah.
It's just, I guess, that the other end, that the local authorities aren't going to suddenly be bestowed with any more money either, are they? So
no, they
are stuck between the rock and the proverbial, aren't they? Going forward, looking at how things might change, operating leases, disposal of lands, etc., can you foresee anything on the horizon which may better equip those schools? Do you think there's any other funding streams or other ways of financing which may stave them off? Or do you think they ultimately are just going to be pushed into larger mats?
I think that it's got to come from both sides, really. I mean, I think that schools, small mats, they need to try and maximise income as much as possible. That may be through something as simple as the hire of facilities. Have buildings, they have these facilities, and they unfortunately need to try and make the most out of it, and that might mean inviting clubs in and you know, other organisations to use those facilities outside of school hours. So they really do need to try and maximise that income. But I think from the other side as well is that they've got to try and really minimise their costs, and that's really tough, I think, for a lot of small mats and standalone schools, because they don't have the kind of the, oh, we can just cut 10% of this or 10% of that, because they're already spending the bare minimum they need to provide an education. That's really tough for them to do that.
My last question to you is, this whole podcast is premised on ways in which we professional services can collaborate. Is there any of your activities where you could see benefit to the client of working with accountants, working with solicitors, working with chartered surveyors, working with banks, energy providers, etc., ways in which we can try and come together? Is there any particular partnerships that you would like to explore?
The first opportunity would be, before they convert, that they approach an alliance, I guess, or a partnership of professional services that can offer them the whole package, as it were. I think quite often these schools that are converting tend to go to solicitors because they need to, and then it's only if anything goes wrong in that process that is brought to their attention by the solicitors or otherwise that they actually seek out other professional services. But actually what would be better suited is if they had that whole package from day one. And then it would be a case of each of those professional services could provide everything that they need in order to convert. And I think, as we've discussed earlier, it's a case of that they would be not playing catch up all the time, but actually they'd be set up to run as an academy trust and in a far stronger position than they would be otherwise.
One final question. Legacy. If you could leave a legacy behind,
okay,
insofar as what you'd like to be able to achieve.
Yeah.
For this particular sector, is there anything you...
Yeah, I think, you know, for me it's about helping as many schools as possible to make sure that they have the financial reporting and information that first of all, that they are compliant, but second of all, that they can make the decisions that they need to in order to provide the best education for the children that are attending those schools. That, for me, is the whole purpose of this, is we have learned as accountants, we have learned as professional people that there are certain things that need to be done in a particular way, and it's about passing on those skills so that those school leaders, those trustees, can better run their schools.
Ultimately, they are in a market. They are competing for resources.
Yeah.
Some of them are blessed and some of them are perhaps cursed. And I agree with you. I want to give every school an opportunity to be able to stand on their own two feet. We alluded earlier on to the idea that schools may be facing being absorbed or joining a MAP. Mm. And those schools have fought for good or outstanding Ofsted ratings. Yeah, those schools have fought to be independent, to be recognised as an individual school within their community.
Yeah.
And it's a tough pill to swallow, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it may well be that they're not going to benefit from economies of scales, but there are those out there who are doing jolly well. I was at a school in Wellingborough recently, and it's a little primary school, and they've got an out-of-hours income of £52,000. That's a couple of teachers.
Yeah.
I was at a school in Twickenham yesterday, admittedly a secondary, but £130,000. Mm. They're useful incomes, aren't they?
Yes, and it's going to be, you know, needed more and more, and it's a case of, obviously, you're talking about those as kind of standout examples now.
Absolutely.
But I think going forward, they're going to be the norm. They've got to be. Yeah.
Right, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, cheers. No worries. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Developing the Trust, the podcast on which we talk all things schools and academisation. Do subscribe to us on iTunes so you don't miss our regularly released conversations with key players from the industry.